and camped along the hills of light. Ye Christian soldiers, rise and press the battle ere the night shall veil the glowing skies. Against the foe in veils below, let all our strength be hurled. Faith is the victory we know that overcomes the world. Faith is the victory. Faith is the victory. Oh, glorious victory that overcomes the world. Now, there's a verse in that song that's missing in the Christian hymnary and many other hymnals. It was in the life songs that I want to sing, and it's my favorite verse. I find that the verses they usually admit are the ones I like in a special way. And this one says, on every hand the foe we find, drawn up in dread array. Let tents of ease be left behind and onward to the fray. Somehow that motivates me to sing that. I'll say that again so you get the words. On every hand the foe we find, drawn up in dread array. Let tents of ease be left behind and onward to the fray. Faith is the victory. On every hand the foe we find, drawn up in dread array. Let tents of ease be left behind and onward to the fray. Salvation's helmet on each brow, with truth all girt about. The earth shall tremble neath our tread and echo with our shout. Faith is the victory. Faith is the victory. Oh, glorious victory that overcomes the world. Sorry about that, I didn't give you the rest of the verse. I was thinking the chorus came right after that. Before I begin, you can turn to the book of Genesis this morning. We're in Genesis 29. This is the 19th sermon from Genesis over a period of 3 years. And I was sort of trying to calculate. It looks to me like there are about six more or so, and about another half year we should finish this. Now, I made a comment the last time that I knew in the back of my mind wasn't quite exactly the way it was, and Brother David Brousseau advised me afterward. It had to do with the descendants of Esau. I said that they basically passed off the scene. Well, they did eventually, but it wasn't quite that simple. In fact, there's a very sobering reality in relation to the prophecy that Isaac gave, where he said, you will eventually throw off the yoke of these people. And how does he say it? When it comes to pass, when thou shalt have dominion, that thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck. I'm amazed at how these prophecies did become fulfilled. And there's something I wanted to say this morning, because it's a matter of historic interest. And it's something maybe that you're not quite aware of. And so I'll just tell you a little bit how that probably, what that's referring to. Here's the nation of Israel. There's the Sea of Galilee. And here is the Dead Sea. And down in this little part of the country was Esau's territory. And they had their ups and downs, but they were not completely gone by the time of Jesus. This was the country known as Edomia. And there's your word Edom, sort of transliterated. and so these people were still here. And a lot of people are not aware of the fact that the Herods that made this agreement with Rome and sort of came in as impostors and ruled Judea during the time of Jesus were actually descendants of Esau. They were Edomians. They were Edomites. And so that prophecy that Isaac gave came true in a most remarkable way in the time of Christ. And then, of course, they were conquered along with all the other people in this land, and eventually they did disappear. I mean, I don't know if there's anybody today who claims any lineage from them or not. But anyway, I just thought I'd point that out, that when God says something or when a true prophecy is given, it will come to pass. Even though it's a prophecy like this, you'd say, well, why did God do that? Well, the New Testament says that by faith, Isaac prophesied of Jacob and Esau. And so this word that he gave did come true.
I don't know what he had in mind. He probably had no idea even what he was saying exactly, but it did come true. All right, now, the last message was on the subject, faith retrieved from failure. And we looked at chapter 28 and chapter 27 and 28 of Genesis, and I called your attention to the fact that, as I see it, everybody in this scenario that we were working with the last time had some grievous failures that took place, and God overruled all of them and retrieved out of it faith. And at the end, we have Jacob going on his way, in spite of all the stuff that had transpired that was less than ideal. We have Jacob going on his way with a remarkable vision of God's connection with earth. And this ladder, which really represents Jesus, he tells us in the New Testament, God is intensely interested in all of the little things that happen. Yes, Eldon's shoulder and all of the other little things that got mentioned this morning. God is interested in all of those, and he intervenes, and there's a communication between heaven and earth. And Jacob had this remarkable vision, and he went on his way rejoicing. So we looked at three things the last time, that God controls failure. And as Paul says in Philippians, he causes things to turn to salvation. That means he salvages bad situations and turns them into something that will further his purpose and bring glory to him. And that's such a wonderful truth that just really blesses me to have the confidence that no matter what happens to me, what happens in life, God will... If you're in his plan and in his kingdom, he causes everything to turn to salvation, to glory. In fact, I've been blessed giving these songs on music to various groups of people. What is it we're to sing about? I gave it here. We're to sing about his salvation, this very characteristic of God, that he intervenes to bring glory and salvation and to turn things into something that brings him praise, no matter what people have done. He causes the wrath of men to praise him. He brings salvation out of that. And that has just been such a blessing to me. So the first point in the message of the last time was God controls failure. In the lives of all the people in these two chapters, God overruled and brought something good out of what would not have been good if it had not been for his intervention and his control of history. And then we notice that God corrects flaws. He controls the evil. He controls failure, I should say. But then he goes about to correct. He doesn't just leave people go on and then he just doctors it all up and makes it okay. He corrects things. He corrects flaws. And so Jacob is chastened by his brother Esau for the thing he did. Poetic justice begins to happen and Jacob becomes chastened. And God's going to deal with his character. We're going to see it in today's lesson. And then the last point was God confirms faith. Now Jacob is a learner. And I'm just blessed by this. I guess that this whole study of Jacob has given me a little bit of a different view of him than what I would have had before I made this study. I would have seen him as sort of a wily, conniving person, person who had become very clever in applied psychology and knew how to manipulate people. I don't quite see Jacob that way. I see Jacob as a true man of faith. I remind you that it says he was a plain man. And that word plain literally means he was a complete man. He was a perfect man. It's a very, very strong comment on the kind of character that Jacob had. And but he had his flaws, and God goes about to deal with those. Jacob is a learner. He has learned a little poem that has been in my mind for many years, and I just jotted it down. Ill that he blesses is our good. An unblessed good is ill. And all is right that seems most wrong if it be his sweet will. I love that little statement. I'll read it again for you. Ill that he blesses is our good. An unblessed good is ill. And all is right that seems most wrong if it is his sweet will. All right? And so Jacob learned that at the end of the last chapter. He's learning that. Jacob is a learner. God still has some things he needs to do with Jacob. And we're going to be working through some of that. Jacob's leap of faith that he took in that last chapter that we looked at, that latter experience, and it brought some things out of Jacob that were remarkable. He made a vow to God. He said, "This is the house of God. If you bring me back, I will come here and worship you. I'll give you a tenth of," and that was voluntary. God wasn't asking for a tenth. That came right out of his heart. "I'll give you a tenth of everything I possess." These are remarkable responses of this man at the end of that last chapter. But as in every experience of that sort, whether it's yours or whether it's a biblical character, God allows that to be tested. And so, today's lesson is faith disciplined by reality. And I'll put my outline on the board for you to follow. Faith disciplined by reality, Genesis 29 to 31. We're going to cover three chapters. Number one, faith disciplined I'm sorry, I'm not writing these the way I have them written on my paper. Let's see. I'm an old literature teacher, so I like alliteration. The discipline of disappointed. Whoop. It's just a little bit too high for me there. Devotion. All right, and that's chapter 29, verses 1 to 30, verse 24. Okay, and number 2, I'm not going to copy this, the discipline of deceitful dealing. And that's chapter 30, verses 45 to 43. 25 to 43, and then last of all is the discipline of difficult hold your hats disengagement. Okay, and that'll be 31, 1 to 55. So these are three very, very trying disciplines that Jacob was exposed to after he had his real clear revelation from God. God allowed him to go through these disciplines, and all of them were extremely difficult. He was really tested. And the beautiful thing about it is he comes through them all with flying colors. You wouldn't have expected that of Jacob, would you? So let's talk about this. 20 long, difficult years away from home. When Rebekah said, "Go to my brother for a little while, and I'll send word to you when Esau's anger has abated, and then you can come back." Well, that never happened. She died, and he stayed 20 years and went through all these experiences that we're talking about this morning. Now, when I say faith discipline by reality, I want you to understand, I mean the reality of a sin-cursed world. The realities he's facing are not the ideal realities that we talk about. They're the realities of what happens in a world where sin has twisted and ruined what should have been. And those are realities, too, that we have to deal with at least until the end of time. I mean, they're just there, and we need to reckon with them because we're going to face them. We're not going to change them. God will use them to change us, and he may change some of them. But anyway, that's the reality we're talking about. So faith discipline by reality. We're going to be dealing with difficult people in this passage and difficult situations that they created. Now, Jacob was not a young fellow when he left home. He was probably, by calculation, if you go and try to calculate the best you can, he probably was around 75 years of age. Now, with the way things were back in that time, as far as people's ages are concerned, we're probably talking about a man maybe, compared with us, maybe 37, 40 years of age. So he was a mature person. He was not just a young fellow. But I'm blessed with what it says right here at the beginning of chapter 29. Right after he had this experience with God, this tremendous revelation, it says, "And Jacob went on his journey," and that literally means he lifted up his feet. So he went on his way, cheerful and reassured. That's what I sort of gather from the way that wording is. He went on his way. Jacob lifted up his feet. By the way, if you had an experience like he had, you'd be sort of walking on air. I don't know how long he stayed there, but when he left, He was immensely encouraged. And that's another thing that blesses me about God. He does let us go through certain disciplines, but then He comes into the picture like He did a number of times in these chapters we're going to look at. He comes into the picture and gives us a fresh experience and revelation of Himself just to cheer us and to give us the guidance and the encouragement that we need. All right. Now, he had no map. He knew he was headed east. His mother probably had told him a little bit what was there, Haran, and what it all sort of looked like. But, you know, this was uncharted territory. And so he sets out on this journey. And the first thing that happens that proves to him that God indeed does intervene in his affairs is he happens to come right to the very well outside of Haran where Abraham's servant had come. Now that well, I'd like to visit that well. There were two major romances took place there in history. And if I ever go to that land, I'd like to visit that well. But anyway, he ends up right at that very same well and he starts talking to the people there and he finds out they're from Haran. Laban, yeah, we know Laban. How's he doing? He's doing wonderful. Oh, and here comes his daughter Rachel. And so immediately he sees this couldn't just be chance, that God had led him to the exact spot where these relatives lived, the exact spot where his mother had come from 100 years before. There he is. And so what happens? Let's just read here for a little bit. Then Jacob went on his journey, lifted up his feet, and came into the land of the people of the east. And he looked, and behold, a well in the field. Now, there probably were many wells in that part of the world, but it's this well. And lo, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it, for out of that well they watered the flocks, and a great stone was upon the well's mouth. And sort of the idea is that they put a big enough rock there that enemies couldn't open it up easily at least and contaminate the water or whatever. And so these flocks would come, and it took probably a couple men to move that huge stone and so they were all waiting. Anyway, and Jacob said unto them, my brethren, whence be ye? And they said, of Haran are we. And he said unto them, know ye Laban, the son of Nahor? And they said, we know him. And he said unto them, is he well? And the word there is shalom. Is he prosperous? How's he doing? And they said, he's well, he's prospering. And behold, Rachel, his daughter, cometh with the sheep. And he said, lo, it is high day. Yet high day, neither is it time that the cattle should be gathered together. Water ye the sheep and go and feed them. I mean, right away you see Jacob's personality. I mean, Jacob says, what are you doing here? It's high day. You should water these sheep and get out there and let them feed. Why are you sitting here? Jacob is a doer. I mean, and when he gets to Laban's flocks, we'll find that he really was a doer. And that's how Laban learned to know him. And so he's wondering why in the world they're messing around here at the well in the middle of the day. And they said, we cannot, until all the flocks be gathered together, until they roll the stone from the well's mouth, then we water the sheep. And while he yet spake with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. Now, that's sort of interesting. We usually think of a shepherd as a man. But apparently her brothers were younger or something, and this woman was a shepherdess. And it came to pass when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. Now notice how many times he says his mother's brother. I think it's three times in this one verse. And that starts to give you a little bit of a hint as to why he responds the way he did. This is so remarkable to him and so blessed to find a relative in the middle of nowhere. And so he says, Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. And Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. I mean, what an entry into this country. Here's this stone that it seems as though one person didn't usually remove it. And Jacob goes, my. I'm sure Rachel had some thoughts at that point about this fellow. Anyway, so he waters her flock. And then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. I just think he was so overcome with emotion. Just so the providence of God, this beautiful woman, his relatives, the way this all turned out just overwhelmed this man. And so he kissed Rachel. And now Laban did too later. I mean, this was a kiss of greeting, but I personally think it meant more than that, knowing what follows in the story. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. It's like I said, it was 100 years before that she had left almost at a moment's notice. And I doubt if they'd ever heard anything from her since. If they would have, it would have been some caravan that would have brought some message back. But it seems as though that may not have happened. And so she was just as astounded as he was at this. I mean, this is a real providence of God. And I just marvel at how God makes these things work. And it came to pass when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob's, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. And he told Laban all these things. And Laban said unto him, surely thou art bone of my flesh. I kind of think he maybe had a family resemblance. And it was obvious to Laban who he was. And he abode with him the space of a month. And Laban said unto Jacob, and that was just long enough for Laban to realize the industry and the personal characteristics of this young man. And Laban said to Jacob, behold, because thou art my brother, shouldest thou therefore serve me for naught? So he actually was helping with, we find out later, he was helping with the sheep. Tell me, what shall thy wages be? And Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah was tender-eyed. Now, we all sort of say, well, that was a blemish. Well, it might not have been. Some people say this is a word that could mean many things. It could be that her eye just didn't quite have the darkness and the depth and the luster of Rachel's. It could be she was also a beautiful person, but it didn't have that special whatever it was that Rachel's eye had. And furthermore, it says Rachel was beautiful and she was well favored. That means not only in countenance, but in her form. She was just a perfect specimen of a female. And so that was what Jacob had observed. And probably during that month, he had gone out and helped with these sheep. She was the shepherdess. I'll let you imagine what might have happened there. Anyway, and Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter. And Laban said, and this just sort of bothers me how cold this is, it's better that I should give her to thee than that I should give her to another man. Abide with me. And then later on, they say we were sold as slaves. These girls realized that their dad used them as pawns. In sort of a business way. And they resented it later on. So they probably resented it now. But it comes out later that they really resented the treatment they had gotten from their father. All right, so anyway, Laban is a very, very wily person. And so now we enter into this first experience here, the discipline of disappointed devotion. Jacob dreams of marrying this woman, and he says, he'll serve for 7 years. He had no dowry. He came there penniless. He tells Laban that later. He said, I had nothing when I came. And he knew in that land you paid a dowry. And he had no dowry. And so he decided, I said he passes all these tests with shining colors. This is a pretty extravagant commitment. I mean, how much money does a man make in a year? Let's make the salary low. Let's say $25,000. Seven times $25,000 is $175,000. That's a pretty nice dowry. And Laban thought so too. And so Laban, by the time this all happened, Laban realized this man was a tremendous asset to him. I mean, we find out later that he knew that. And I think he knew it after a month, that here was a man, you don't sit at the well at noon. I mean, you get the sheep watered and you tend this flock. And so he says to him, that's fine. And of course, you know what happened. He comes up with this diabolical idea that he will give him Leah, and then he knows this boy loves the other one, and he doesn't ask him anything about what he's going to do about that when it all comes out. In fact, would you turn over to chapter 29? Laban tells him what the bargain's going to be. Now it's a bargain. Before, he let Jacob set the terms, and Jacob said, I'll serve you 7 years for Rachel. But he says, verse 27, fulfill her week, Leah's week, and we will give thee also this for the service which thou shalt serve with me yet another 7 years. So this man had connived to get 14 years out of Jacob when Jacob had originally given him a very generous offer of 7 years. So here he has 14 years of free labor out of Jacob. How does Jacob handle this? And not only that, But this man not only connived to cheat him out of 7 years of his life, but he also forced polygamy on him. With all the sorrows and heart-wrenching stuff that that resulted in. I mean, Jacob ended up trying to please four women. Anyway. And it was all because of Laban. Laban gave him Bilhah with Rachel, and then, of course, he insisted he... with Leah. And then he insisted he worked 7 more years, and he gave him Rachel with Zilpah. So he had these 4 women. Now, Jacob could have said, I repudiate this marriage to Leah. You have cheated me. I will not do it. I think most men would have, that's how they would have responded. They just said, I'm not going through with this. Just not going to do it. You know, and could have really, really laid it on Leah, because she obviously had gone along with this. We find out later she really did love Jacob. I think actually she loved Jacob in a deeper way than what Rachel did. And I don't know what Rachel was doing all this time. She must have gone off somewhere in seclusion. And anyway, Jacob could have, he could have given Leah a good piece of his mind for going along with this. He could have given Laban a good piece of his mind, and he could have rejected the whole thing. But he didn't do that. The whole way through. Now, he couldn't help the fact that his heart was drawn in a special way to Rachel. I mean, he couldn't help that. I mean, I'm not going to blame the man for that. But having taken that into consideration, he really treated Leah pretty equitably. And in the end, Leah had a real love for this man. And so he apparently had treated her well. All right. Well, he says to Laban, let's look what he says in verse 25. I mean, this would have been relatively easy to pull off because they didn't have electric lights in those days. You didn't go into the tent and turn on the light. So she came to him veiled, and in those days the veil basically would have covered not only her head, but probably hung down in a loose second piece of clothing that would have sort of concealed her whole form. And so then during the night there's no light. She probably was in many ways similar to Rachel, and probably they didn't even talk out loud to each other. They probably whispered in the dark. And so when it was all over, he woke up, she takes off the veil, and anyway. All right. And I think she probably could have helped along with it. I mean, obviously, you'd have tried to disguise yourself as Rachel. You'd have worn some of her clothes, some of her perfume. I mean, I don't know what all went into this. I mean, your imagination's as good as mine. Anyway, it happened. Verse 25, and it came to pass that in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this thou hast done unto me? Did not I serve with thee for Rachel? Wherefore hast thou beguiled me? Oh, that's an interesting word. Beguiled. I don't even think we have to imagine that Jacob remembered that there was a day when his father thought he was Esau. And it was not. And here he thought it was Rachel, and it was Leah. The chickens have sort of come home to roost. All right, so now he ends up in this very, very bad situation with 2 wives. And like I said, this is a test of disappointed devotion. And there's not a hint in this passage that Jacob rebelled against that. I think he saw that God had, for reasons unknown to him, had allowed this to happen. The fact of the matter is, Leah was the one that bore Judah and Levi, not Rachel. The priestly tribe, the kingly tribe, and the Messiah tribe came out of Leah. And Jacob, of course, didn't know all that. But it's like a lot of things we don't know. He said, this is what I have been handed. This is what God has allowed. Perhaps as a discipline upon my own sin, whatever. I shall do my part. I like that. That's very commendable on the part of Jacob. But God did not forget the situation. He realized that Leah was going to be in a very bad situation. So he closes up Sarah's womb. He opens up Leah's womb. And she has 4 sons in a row. And we look at their names. And we get a real insight into Leah. You know, I always had this picture. This poor Leah was this helpless soul. Jacob didn't really want to marry. She was sort of a pitiful somebody. And that's the picture that you sort of get if you're not careful. But that's not the picture you get if you study her carefully. The names show her God consciousness. Reuben. She says, "Behold a son. The Lord has looked upon my..." Well, let's just read it the way she said it. And Leah conceived, verse 32 of 29. And Leah conceived and bare a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, "Surely the Lord..." See, she saw the Lord. Now, when you get to Rachel, you don't see any of this. You don't see any calling on the Lord or recognizing the Lord. You have a wrong impression about Leah if you're not careful, and you really have a wrong impression about Rachel. She turns out not to be a very spiritual woman. Now, God took her through a lot of difficulty, and I think chastened her, and Joseph was her son, and I think we see in Joseph what she finally became at the end of her life. But God had to take her through a process. But Leah, from the very beginning, shows a real God consciousness. She says, "Surely the Lord hath looked upon my affliction. Now therefore will my husband love me." And so his name literally means, "Behold a son." And then she has Simeon, verse 33. And she says, "Because the Lord..." See her God consciousness here. "Because the Lord hath heard that I was hated." So Simeon is from the Hebrew word Shema. Simeon, which means to hear. She says, "God has heard me." All right? "Has heard that I was hated." And she conceived again and bare a son. And she said, "Now this time will my husband be joined unto me." That shows you that she was devoted to Jacob. She wanted his love. She wanted his devotion. And so that's what she named her child. And she conceived again and bare a son. And she said, "Now will I praise the Lord." Therefore she called his name Judah. And Judah literally means praise. And that says that when this was all over, it was all over. She didn't say, "Well, you know, my focus is on Jacob." In the end, her focus was on God. She was a very God-conscious woman. All right? And as I told you, Levi and Judah were the two very important tribes as far as history is concerned. And they're born right here at the beginning of this whole situation. And you could say that Israel's origin was by faith. If Jacob would have had his way, he'd have never married Leah. And God obviously would have worked it out some other way, but these two men would not have been born, at least in the way they were. So you can say that Israel's origin was literally an origin of faith. It was something beyond anything that Jacob would have desired or done. God did it. And this is how he did it. It was not Jacob's natural choice. Now, while we're looking at Leah, let's look just a little bit at Rachel. Rachel had the beauty and the love of her husband, which Leah did not have. And yet she was discontented. She was petulant. She was determined that she had to have that too. Now, we don't read that kind of response from Leah. Now, we don't know what Leah did. It doesn't say. But we do get this from Rachel. And even when Joseph was born, she called him Joseph, which means "God shall add." Now, that might have been a statement of faith. It might also have been a statement of, "This is still not enough to suit me." I don't know. I don't know what it was. But anyway, that's the picture you get of Rachel. She was focused on Jacob, not on God. She went to Jacob and cried out to him, "Give me a son ere I die." And an interesting little footnote is she literally did die in the birth of her second son. I mean, you know, we need to be careful what we say. And of all people, I need to say that to myself. Our words, actually, God does hear them. And our words are creative. Not in the same way God's are, but we are in the image of God, and our words are creative. And she said, "Give me a son, or ere I die." And she died. The birth of her second son. But why didn't she cry out to God? Why didn't we read that she cried out to God, "God, would you see my situation?" She didn't do it. She cried out to Jacob. In fact, she bawled him out. Very unreasonably. And Jacob is God-conscious. In fact, you see that all through these chapters. It's just a blessing if you look for it. Jacob's instinctive response in these difficult situations is to give God recognition. And he said, I'm not God. In fact, he sort of rebukes her. He says, God hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb. That's maybe a little bit of a veiled statement that maybe it's a problem you have in your life. God's dealing with you. I don't know if that's what he meant or not, but it could have been. And then when she finally has children by her handmaiden, Bilhah, and of course that's what happens next. She's so desperate for children, and she did that in spite of the fact that I'm sure she knew that Sarah had done it and had caused no end of grief. But she wanted children so badly, she was willing to ignore that bad example and all the sorrow it had brought, and she goes ahead and does the same thing. And not only that, her example leads Leah to do it. I mean, it's just a chain reaction of bad things from this woman's bad decision. But when she had children by Bilhah, what did she name them? Not the kind of names that Leah gave to hers that call attention to God's dealings with her. She says, Dan, God has judged me. He has vindicated me. And then Naphtali is born, and she said, I've wrestled with my sister, and I've won. That's Rachel. That's basically what you get coming from Rachel. Not only that, but she took her father's idols. We'll talk about that a little bit later. I don't know what that was all about, but she's the one that took the idols along when they left the land. So the picture you get of Rachel, aside from her natural beauty, and aside from a little note near the end of this whole sordid story, doesn't really present a very good picture. But God had dealings with her. Very, very strong dealings, and I think she made progress. All right. Anyway, so we have these children all born. Now Jacob had 8 sons. All right. Now, Reuben was about 7 years of age by this time, and he was old enough to go out when they were out working in the fields. I don't know if he was helping the people with the wheat harvest or if he was just out there playing, and he found these mandrakes. And so he brings them to his mother. Oh, another sidelight on Rachel. Now, I don't know what these mandrakes were. They say they were sort of an orange berry that they thought would help with fertility. That's what they thought they would do if you ate them. And that's what they believed. And so this boy comes with these mandrakes, and Rachel sees them, and she wants them. And so she bargains with Leah, if you let me have the mandrakes, I'll let you have Jacob for the night. I mean, I look at this domestic situation and I thank the Lord that somehow polygamy was done away with. So Leah doesn't have the mandrakes, but she has Jacob. And of course she conceives. And again, Issachar is born. And his name is Reward. And then Zebulun is born. His name is Dwelling. And finally, and she says, now, I've borne my husband enough sons that I'm sure he'll spend time with me rather than with Rachel. Because it seemed like, you know, he was spending more time with Bilhah and so on. And Leah wanted Jacob to spend time with her. And then she finally had a daughter. It's the only daughter that's named. It says he had other daughters, but they aren't named. And finally, in verse 22, listen to this. And God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her, so now she is praying. The mandrakes didn't work. She's praying. And he opened her womb, and she conceived and bare a son. She said, God has taken away my reproach. His name means judge. And she called his name Joseph. She said, God shall add to me another son. It had those two meanings. God shall judge and God shall add. And so finally, her faith is rewarded too, after God had disciplined her. So, our first point, the discipline of disappointed devotion, and we see various people in this passage responding to that, Jacob, Leah, and Rachel, and Jacob passed that test pretty well. Now, the next one is the discipline of deceitful dealings. He had Laban to deal with. All right? Now, Joseph had fulfilled his contract. He had served 14 years, and he had 12 children. And his work had been very productive for Laban. But he had nothing. He tells Laban that. He says, look, Let's skip over a little bit to verse 30. For it was little which thou hadst before I came, and it is now increased unto a multitude, and the Lord, see, his recognition is constantly the Lord. The Lord hath blessed thee since my coming, and now when shall I provide for my own house also? Poor Jacob. He's worked 14 years, and this man has become immensely wealthy, and he has nothing. And he says, it's time for me to leave. It's time for me to go back to my home. He wanted to go home. Well, Laban by this time knows that he had little when Jacob came, and now he's rich. And so he says to Jacob, he says, look, I'm willing to pay you. You have nothing. I don't know why he thought Jacob would trust him at this point. I mean, he worked 14 years, and the man had never given him anything and had cheated him. And now he says, now you set the terms. Well, the last time Jacob set the terms didn't turn out too well. But good old Jacob, he decides to set the terms. Now, I'm going to read down through this because unless we go down detail by detail, you won't quite get what happened here. So let's start with verse 25 of 30. And it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph, and Jacob said, that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go into mine own place, to my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served thee, and let me go, for thou knowest my service which I have done to thee. I've done you no wrong. I've blessed you. Now, reward me by letting me go. And Laban said unto him, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience. You know, people like Laban, that's the only way they ever do learn. I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake. And he said, appoint me thy wages, and I will give it. And he said unto him, thou knowest how I have served thee, this is Jacob speaking, and how thy cattle was with me. For it was little which thou hadst before I came, and now it is increased unto a multitude, and the Lord hath blessed thee since my coming, and now when shall I provide for mine own house also? And he said, what shall I give thee? Set the wages. And Jacob said, thou shalt not give me anything. Now you're going to see that this is very interesting how he dealt with Laban. By this time, I think Jacob's faith has grown. And by this time he knows that if anything happens to him, it'll be straight from God. He does not need Laban's blessing. He does not need to bargain with Laban. It wouldn't do any good anyway because Laban is not a person who keeps any bargains or at least finds a way to turn the bargain in his own favor and against you, and you end up with nothing. And so Jacob said, look, I'm not going to disappoint myself again. I'm not going to trust you one more time. My trust is in God, and you're not going to give me anything. All right? If thou wilt do this thing for me, I have a proposal to make. I will again feed and keep thy flock. I will pass through all the flock today, removing from thence all the speckled and spotted cattle and all the brown cattle among the sheep and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and of such shall be my hire. So shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come. Now there is a principle here, by the way. Don't ever obligate yourself to an evil person. You know, Christians get involved in all kinds of... We talk about unequal yoke. Here it is. Jacob said, I'm not going to become involved with you. In the time to come, when it really, really counts, I'm going to have it said that I did not take anything from you. You can't accuse me of taking anything, of taking advantage of you in any way. In fact, I took advantage of myself. All right? So shall my righteousness answer me for in the time to come when it shall be for my hire before thy face. We're talking about discipline of deceitful dealings. This was a real discipline that Jacob put himself under here. All right? Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and the brown among the sheep, that shall be counted stolen with me. If you find any animal among my flocks that doesn't have any marks on it, you can say I stole it. Okay? And Laban said, behold, I would it might be according to thy word. Now, we haven't told everything that was involved here. It comes out later that there was something else that was part of the agreement. And he removed that day the goats that were ring-streaked and spotted, and all the she-goats that were speckled and spotted, and every one that had some white on it, and all the brown among the sheep, and gave them into the hands of his sons. Laban did this. It seems like it was part of the agreement, but even if it wasn't part of the agreement, this is what happened. And he set 3 days' journey betwixt himself and Jacob, and Jacob fed the rest of his flocks. Now, what happened here? Either Jacob had agreed to this, or Laban just did it. He took all the speckled ones out, and he sent them 3 days away, so there was no way they could breed with the ones that had no specks. And he honestly believed, he didn't understand very much about genetics, he honestly believed that now there would be no speckled ones. He sent them all the breeding stock that was speckled went. 3 days away. There's no way they'd ever get together. And he thought he had a pretty good deal. Jacob said, My wages are going to be the speckled ones. And Laban made sure there would be no speckled ones. All right? Let's read the next part. And Jacob took him rods of green poplar and of hazel and chestnut tree and peeled white streaks in them. In other words, he peeled off the bark so you could see the white wood beneath. And made the white appear which was in the rods. And he set the rods which he had peeled before the flocks in the gutters in the watering troughs when the flocks came to drink, that they should conceive when they came to drink. And the flocks conceived before the rods and brought forth cattle ring-streaked, speckled, and spotted. Now we all know that those animals looking at those streaked and specked stuff in their troughs did not, because of that, give birth to speckled and streaked animals. I mean, we know scientifically that makes no sense. But we don't know what went on here. You must remember, Jacob was 95 years old at this point. And he knew something that I have a sneaking suspicion that maybe geneticists and people that specialize in reproduction today don't even understand. I don't know. I mean, obviously he did something here that he had tried. I mean, he was an experienced herdman. I don't know if there was a chemical in those rods that did something to the fertility of these animals. I have no idea. I mean, the Bible just doesn't explain this, but this is the Bible. But the fact of the matter is, if he was only going to have the ones that had the recessive genes, they were probably always going to be fewer than the ones that had the dominant genes, but God intervened here. God intervened here, and this prospered all out of proportion to what Jacob expected. And Jacob did, verse 40, and Jacob did separate the lambs and set the faces of the flocks toward the ring-streaked and all the brown in the flock of Laban, and he put his own flocks by themselves and put them not unto Laban's cattle. So he was separating these ones that were being born that were ring-streaked, and he put them all by themselves, and he turned the cattle so they could all look at them day after day. Whatever that did, I don't know. And it came to pass, whensoever the stronger cattle did conceive, that Jacob laid the rods before their eyes, so they would be fertile, or whatever was going on there, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the cattle were feeble, he put them not in. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger were Jacob's. Now, God doesn't condemn this at all, and this was not deceit. I mean, this was all within the realm of husbandry. I mean, if Jacob knew something Laban didn't know, that he was managing the flock. But God was in it. He says later that he had a vision. And God showed him this vision that all of the males that bred the females were ring-strecked and specked. Well, they weren't, because the flocks he had were Laban's flocks and they were all homogeneous. I mean, they all were, what do you call it, without any marks. But God showed him that what really was going on is there was genes of ring-strecked and speckled in those animals as they were breeding. And he was going to have ring-strecked and specked cattle. God showed him that vision. So, I mean, God actually approves of this. So, I mean, we can't argue with it. I mean, God apparently was in all, well, he was in all of it. And the man increased exceedingly and had much cattle and maidservants and manservants and camels and asses. And by the way, this is 6 years. This is not 20 years. This is 6 years. His flocks outnumber Laban's, it seems, and he has servants, and he has, you know, and Laban has the feeble ones. They're all one color, but they're not very strong, and they're not very many. So what's the lesson here? It is to totally let Laban do his thing. Let people take advantage. Let them do the sharp deal. Let them do whatever they want to do. My trust is in God. Now, he did use a little bit of means there, I must admit. But that didn't explain what happened. He made a deal that to Laban looked like he was guaranteed to lose, and Laban was guaranteed to win, and God overruled it. And that's what Jacob wanted. All right? So I'd say he did pretty well in that discipline. So he did well in that one. He did well in this one. Now we'll go on to the next one. He finally has to get disentangled from Laban, but now he's really entangled with Laban. Laban does not want him to go. Laban has prospered. He's rich. It's all because of Jacob. Even though his cattle are a little feeble, he's still doing better than he did when Jacob showed up. So, and he heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's. Of that which was our father's hath he gotten all this glory. The word glory there means wealth. And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. And the Lord said unto Jacob, return into the land of thy fathers and to thy kindred. So now God steps in, and he has a command from the Lord. You are to leave. And so Jacob called Leah and Rachel, and he explains to them that he's leaving, and explains why. Notice what what he did to him. Notice what Laban had done with this deal. I just wanted to call it your attention, verse 7. And your father hath deceived me in this deal and changed my wages 10 times, but God suffered him not to hurt me. Now look what he did. If he said thus, the speckled shall be thy wages, then all the cattle bear speckled. So what Laban did is after a while he said, no, look, Jacob, you can have only the speckled ones. The ring-streaked ones you can't have. And Jacob said, when he said that, then the Lord made them all speckled. And if he said, now, Jacob, you can have the ring-streaked ones, but the speckled ones you can't have. Then they were all ring-streaked. I mean, that was the game Laban was playing. But God didn't let him win. Thus God hath taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. And it came to pass, and he tells about this vision. And then he says God had spoken to him. Verse 13, I am the God of Bethel, whom thou anointest, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowest a vow unto me. Now rise, get into the land. And Rachel and Leah said to him, is there yet any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not counted of him as strangers? He sold us, and has quite devoured all our money. All right? For all the riches which God has taken from our father, that is ours. All God has done is given you what belonged to us that our father took away. God has, there's justice here. Yes, of course we'll go with you. There's nothing here. So Jacob rose up to leave. And, of course, we know that Rachel took the images. And then Laban sets out after him. After they've gone 3 days, Laban sets out after him. It takes him 7 days. So it's 10 days till Laban gets there. By this time, he's 300 miles away. And there's no question that Laban has determined to deal with this whole situation, either bring the cattle back, kill Jacob, or whatever. I mean, he was set on doing nothing good. And God spoke to him in the night and said, take heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. Verse 24. And so Laban comes, and then he tries to act like, well, he feels so bad that they left, and he didn't get a chance to say goodbye, and he wanted to kiss his children. And I mean, he all of a sudden acts like he has a love that he never showed before. And then he says in verse 29, it is in the power of my hand to do you hurt. I mean, he's just a big braggart here. And the only reason I'm not going to do it is because God told me not to. Take heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. He said, God said that to me, and I'm going to follow through. And now, though thou wouldest needs be gone, because thou sore longest after thy father's house. I mean, that's real sarcasm there. Wherefore hast thou stolen my gods? So he accuses him. Of course, Jacob didn't know what happened, so he said, whoever has the gods will have to die. Now, we don't know why Rachel took these gods, but apparently she was still an idolater somewhat at heart. Did she take them so that she felt they'd be protected from her father if they had had his gods? Did she take them so that they would have direction that they needed on the way? Did she take them because she wanted Laban to give up his idolatry? Did she take them? There are many things that you could say could be reasons. But anyway, she's as wily as he is, so she claims that she's having her woman's monthly experience, and That's the one place Laban didn't look. He figured there's no way that a woman would defile my gods by sitting on them in that shape. And then, of course, that's exactly where they were. And then Jacob was really upset. I mean, he'd had all the pent-up frustration of all the years, so I'm going to read his frustration and we'll soon be through here. And Jacob was wroth and chode with Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that thou hast so hotly pursued after me? Whereas thou hast searched all my stuff, what hast thou found of all thy household stuff? Set it here before my brethren and thy brethren, that they may judge betwixt us both. This 20 years have I been with thee. Thy yoes and thy she-goats have not cast their young." He was a good herdsman. "That which was torn of beasts I brought not unto thee." Now, it was understood that if a shepherd lost an animal, the employer, that was his loss. But Jacob said, "No, I took that loss. I took the loss. I bear the loss of it. Of my hand didst thou require it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night." In other words, whether he wanted to do that or not, that's what Laban said he had to do. He had to bear all the losses. "Thus I was in the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from mine eyes. Thus have I been 20 years in thy house. I served thee 14 years for thy 2 daughters, and 6 years for thy cattle, and thou hast changed my wages 10 times. And we saw what he was doing. "Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac, had been with me, surely thou hadst sent me away empty. But God hath seen my affliction and the labor of my hands, and rebuked thee yesternight." And finally, this old hard-hearted Laban had nothing to say. And so now he turns sweet. He says, "Let's make a covenant. You know, let's make a covenant. You know, I want to bless you." What would you have done? Jacob freely forgave him. He made the covenant. He promised never to harm Laban. I think Laban was making it for his own protection. I mean, he thought, now someday Jacob's going to remember all this. And he's going to come marching back to the land of Haran. He's going to set the score. So he makes sure that he's protected. And Jacob, in true forgiveness, has no desire to ever have revenge on Laban. And so he very freely goes along with the covenant. He sets up a pillar. He worships. He makes commitments again. Beautiful response. And he did his sacrifice for the first time. Jacob is making progress. So Jacob passed this one too. Difficult disengagement. How do you relate to the enemy? How do you get yourself disentangled from wrong? From 20 years of mistreatment? How do you separate yourself with that and have a clean heart? Well, you do it with forgiveness, like he did. And so all three of these tests, Jacob treats everybody right. Even though he got into a horrendous situation he had never chosen to get into that was very difficult and brought him heart-wrenching sorrow, he did not in any way allow himself to be brought into any obligation to Laban. He trusted it all to the Lord and gave God all the glory. And when it came to the end, when he had to make this difficult separation from the man who had taken advantage of him at every turn, had no love or real care for him, he freely forgave him. And so that's why when I was studying this, I thought, well, the best title for this is Faith Disciplined by Reality. Something had happened that night when Jacob saw that ladder. It wasn't just some inspiration. Jacob got a hold of something that night, that God was in his affairs. And all he had to do, a little bit like we're going to find with Joseph later, all he had to do was in all the disciplines of life, look to God, trust God, make the right response to the people around him. God would defend. God would take care. God would save. God would turn. God would salvage. God would be his salvation. I ask you, you're going to have disciplines in all these areas too. Do you do your duty no matter what has happened to your love? Do you live in a way that you can truly say that God prospered you no matter what anybody tried to do? And you did not in any way take advantage of them or give them back what they had given to you? And do you forgive when it's all over? It's a beautiful lesson we learned from this man. Now I'm finished. Does anybody have any comments you want to make?